Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 81, Understanding the Anxiety Disorders. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Stress hormone is cortisol. In fact, that's what we're measuring a lot today is cortisol, where GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid, would be the happy hormone, you know, that stimulates dopamine. So it's called the happy, where cortisol is the stress hormone. We really need cortisol to help us respond appropriately to a stressor or to a perceived emergency, but then we need enough cortisol to help bring us back down again. So cortisol is a very critical part of our life. And in fact, some of the research in reference to cortisol, we're understanding that cortisol plays a significant part in post-trauma stress in actually helping to develop some of the receptor sites in neurotransmitters. And it actually helps to establish some of that stress response, the emotional response to stress.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Wayne Eastlack. Wayne Eastlack, Ph.D., is Clinical Director of Providence Place Outpatient Counseling and Treatment Service in High Point, North Carolina. Dr. Eastlack also serves as a professor of abnormal psychology at Liberty University Graduate School. For nearly 30 years, he's directed a family practice specializing in the treatment of anxiety disorders and depression in adults, adolescents, and children. Dr. Eastlack has also served as a pastoral counselor. Dr. Eastlack was awarded 2 commendations of meritorious service to his country by the Department of the Navy and the United States Marine Corps for his military service during the Vietnam War and his work as a prison therapist. This background provided him with firsthand insight and expertise into post-traumatic stress assessment and treatment design. Dr. Eastlack has been a popular speaker for conferences, seminars, and keynote presentations for many years. He's recognized for his warm, engaging, and entertaining lectures that provide a wealth of practical information and clinical insights for all mental health professionals. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Wayne Eastlack, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Dave, happy to be with you. It's been a pleasure.
That's great. Yeah. Well, you know, I was reading some background on you, and I'm intrigued by some of what I have read about your background. For example, I see that you have 2 commendations by the Navy and the Marine Corps for service during the Vietnam War. What was that for?
This was work that I had done both for the Department of the Navy and the Marine Corps. I was in the Marine Corps during the Vietnam War, and one of the commendations that I had received had been in reference to prisoner transport and some lead positions that I had taken in reference to prison transport to keep everyone safe in reference to prison transport. And the other one was as a psychologist within a military prison, I developed a quick system analysis system for classifying prisoners, because there were a lot of them had post-trauma stress disorder, and so for each of those I had received a commendation for, and with that became a rank promotion for each one too. So I ended up making rank quite quickly.
Oh, very good. Yeah, very good.
And so with those commendations came a rank promotion.
So you were
nothing spectacular, just some work that I had done for both the Navy and the Department of the Marine Corps.
Yeah, well, it sounds very fascinating. So you were a psychologist already back
then. That's right.
And
that's right.
And you were actually developing post-traumatic approaches for North Vietnamese prisoners?
No, actually, they were for American prisoners that had suffered post-trauma stress disorder and had developed a program for classification, because we had to do some pretty quick work at that point, you know, because the Vietnam War was not a very popular war, if you'll remember, back in those days.
Oh, I remember very clearly.
And so, yeah, and the Marine Corps prison system used to be what's called Red Line, which was a very harsh prison system, and so I helped in the redevelopment of the prison system and developed some analysis techniques that they actually still use today. But I developed that and got a commendation from the Department of the Navy for that. Teaching how to do prison escort work, especially if you're transporting them across the country, you know, basically what to look for and how to do it in a safe manner. So, and I got another commendation from that from the Department of the Marine Corps.
Well, you know, this raises a whole issue that I wasn't planning to go into, but it's too juicy for me to pass up. And that's Abu Ghraib, and also the whole debate that's raging within the American Psychological Association about the appropriate role of psychologists in relation to military prisons, interrogation, etc. I wonder if you have any comments or perspective on any of that.
Well, I probably don't have anything real current, because it's been about 35 years since I've been part of the prison system, you know, in the military setting. But as far as the psychologist's role is concerned within this context, what specifically are you asking with that?
Oh, well, maybe you haven't followed that debate.
Probably not,
okay.
Dave. Yeah.
Well, we don't need to go there, but there. Just to bring you up to speed real quick, there. The APA developed different ethical standards than the American the American Psychiatric Association did. The American Psychiatric Association's standards are more strict and basically say hands off, no involvement whatsoever. Whereas the APA kind of left the door open, saying, well, as long as psychologists aren't directly involved in interrogation, they can be consultants. And the pro argument is that they can help soften what might otherwise be a more brutal system. And the con argument is psychologists should not have anything to do with anything that doesn't involve, you know, basically treatment and healing.
Sure, yeah.
So there's quite a conflict raging about that. But mm-hmm. But that's not really what we were going to talk about today anyway. You've been doing a lot of work in the area of anxiety disorders, and I know you've been doing workshops around the country on anxiety disorders, and we'll talk about those more towards the end of the show. How did you get into that particular specialty?
Well, that was an area of specialty that I had gotten into back when I was doing my doctoral work, and then that became part of my research project in my doctoral work, and that's really what got me started in that. And so I developed quite a strong association with the National Institute of Mental Health in reference to the etiology of anxiety disorders and some of the treatment designs and where we're going to go with this, since anxiety disorders was on a tremendous increase and has just been increasing from year to year, really. And so it has just grown into kind of a big thing with me. So I'm on the road. I'm in a treatment program here at my office every other week, and then I'm on the road every other week teaching, you know, some of the research, some of the diagnostic criteria, some of the treatment ideas today.
Now you said that, did I understand you to say that anxiety disorders are on the increase?
Yes.
And do you think that's because of changing diagnostic criteria, or because the underlying disorder is actually on the increase?
Well, you know what? It may be a combination of both. I think there are more people feeling safe about reporting for treatment. I think the diagnostic criteria is becoming more clear-cut. I think the treatment options are a little bit better, and yet at the same time, you know, we're living in a pretty stressed world, and we're even seeing anxiety disorders younger and younger all the time. Most of the time when I'm doing seminars and workshops, you know, one of the major issues is the fact that, you know, they're seeing more and more children with anxiety disorders. And
when you say children, going down to what age are we talking about?
Oh, my goodness. It can go down to age 5 and 6, you know, in that area there. I just read a recent report from Harvard University, a research study, where they were saying, you know, it may be possible that a child could be born with anxiety disorder in reference to the serum cortisol levels, and that's what they were looking at, were serum cortisol levels in the child, and they saw that that may even give them a greater propensity toward their life, toward anxiety, stress disorders, maybe even post-trauma stress, making them more vulnerable to it. So
That's interesting. That makes sense that there is maybe a biological, physiological predisposition. I've been studying a little bit about positive psychology, and they talk about a set point in terms of our our happiness level, and I suppose our anxiety level would be, you know, inversely related.
Well, I think part of the interest today is in the context of research and neurobiology. We're just better equipped to study the brain and its effects of stress today. And we see a dopamine factor there, you know, within the primitive part of the brain and the amygdala and the hippocampus and all of this and its effects right down to the cellular level of the body. You know, of how chronic stress just creeps up on us, and it's just more intense today. It's like people are handling more things. My goodness, if you even watch the TV screen or try to watch the news, you know, very often it's in quadrants of more than one person on the screen at the same time. And then you've got bands going across the top and down the side and across the bottom giving you the weather.
Yeah.
and it's like, you know, we're just having to engage so much more. And then the whole technology of computers has gotten us even engaged that much more. And I think it's a kind of a chronic stress that creeps up on us. You know, I think we're sort of designed to handle the bigger stressors that we can see coming at us. You know, it's a chronic low grade stress that kind of creeps up on us like a cheap wine. You know, that gets us eventually and affects our threshold, and we're not aware of it, and then we become vulnerable to either panic attack, you know, or maybe an anxiety disorder.
Well, you're totally right about the pace of life these days. I was reflecting just this morning. I'm supposedly retired, and I feel constantly behind. How can a guy who's retired be behind?
Yeah, you're supposed to be behind a little bit now, but we get anxious about it, saying, you know, how far are we going to drop behind here?
Right. So we should probably back up a bit here and start off by having you define anxiety. I remember a definition from when I was in graduate school, but that was a long time ago. It may have changed. How is anxiety understood today?
Well, I'm not sure that it's changed tremendously over thousands of years, actually, you know, because you can see it defined, you know, by many authors throughout the years, but it's still there, you know, where both the physiological, psychological, and emotional response to stress, where it has heightened our awareness. I mean, there are even good stressors that just heighten us, and we're designed for that, really. We can handle that pretty well. We have quite a good system that works there. But I think it's the chronic low-grade stressors each day that our brain tends to normalize, and therefore we become not as aware, and they just kind of collect, and then we start seeing some of the physiological factors, you know, whether it be difficulty sleeping, more headaches, and this is even before we're aware that it might be stress, you know. There could be sexual dysfunction that comes into it, cold hands and feet. My goodness. Maybe some heart palpitations, mm-hmm. you know, just in the physical element of it before we're even aware of some of it. But maybe not sleeping so well, or worry is one of the big things in the context of, for example, generalized anxiety disorder, characterized by worry about everything.
Yes.
Just worry.
And the phenomenological, psychological experience of anxiety, isn't that closely related to fear? Is it?
Does it feel?
I remember it being defined as sort of the feeling of being afraid but not knowing what you're afraid of.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you get in that fear component. You know, we've got a primitive part of our brain that responds to fear. It's our preservation part of our brain, the limbic system, and within that is the amygdala, and it responds to fear. You know. And then we have our hippocampus right behind it that's trying to identify it, you know, say, well, if you're feeling this fear, maybe we can identify something here. So it's grasping for anything, mm-hmm. and it just kind of feeds itself, you know. And then the prefrontal cortex, you know, that is supposed to, you know, rationalize this out and sort it out and say, whoa. Well, if you're still feeling that strongly about it, maybe you better go check it out. You know?
Yeah.
And this component just keeps traveling through us. You know?
Yeah, you know, for me,
it's a tough one.
For me, the archetypal experience of anxiety in my own life, and I suspect I'm not alone in this, is I call it the 3 a.m. experience, or the hour of the wolf, where sometimes I'll wake up in the middle of the night and somehow all the defenses, all my defense mechanisms that I have during the day that's able to sort things into perspective, those don't seem to
right.
be there. And it feels like I'm just naked and raw against fears and worries and so on. Is that a fairly universal experience, or do I need to check myself in?
Well, it really is, and sometimes it's manifested at that time of the morning in depression mm-hmm. or feelings of loss.
Okay.
Because you know we're in those sleep cycles, and some of our mechanisms are pretty relaxed, some of our defense mechanisms, you know, but you've also got the stress hormone that is starting to increase again at about that time, and peaks at about 6 o'clock in the morning, and so anytime between like 3 and 6 in the morning we can experience anxiety and feel really quite vulnerable to it at that point, especially if we wake up and find ourselves quite vulnerable. And that would be the emotional vulnerability that would be expressed as some anxiety. And so that's not an uncommon phenomenon, Dave.
Mm-hmm. And stress hormone, I've never heard that term before. What is the stress hormone?
Stress hormone is cortisol. In fact, that's what we're measuring a lot today is cortisol. Where GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid, would be the happy hormone, you know, that stimulates dopamine. So it's called the happy, where cortisol is the stress hormone. We really need cortisol to help us respond appropriately to a stressor or to a perceived emergency, but then we need enough cortisol to help bring us back down again. So cortisol is a very critical part of our life, and in fact, some of the research in reference to cortisol, we're understanding that cortisol plays a significant part in post-trauma stress in actually helping to develop some of the receptor sites in neurotransmitters, and it actually helps to establish some of that stress response, the emotional response to stress. And I was just reading an interesting article from Harvard University that they found that if they can use a beta blocker in the treatment option, now beta blockers are basically a heart medication, keeps your heart rate under about 120 beats a minute, and they're saying if we can use a beta blocker, sometimes it will interfere with cortisol developing those emotional patterns within the neurons, you know, the receptor sites at the neurons. And so it may be a very, and this is just recent, beta blockers have been around for a long time and sometimes used in the stress response, but we weren't exactly sure what they did. Now we see its effect on cortisol is very valuable in treating anxiety disorders today. So,
Wow. It sounds like our understanding.
Yeah, cortisol is quite significant.
Yeah, it
peaks in the morning at about 6 o'clock. So cortisol and 6 cups of coffee and you're out the door.
There we go.
Right? Even for semi-retired people, Dave.
Yeah. So what are the main types of anxiety disorders then? I know the DSM lists quite a few. Can you run through them quickly?
Yeah, of course, there's panic disorder with or without agoraphobia. Goodness, there would be generalized anxiety disorder, post-trauma stress disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder with all of its variations, plus its spectrum disorders in there. Your eating disorders come under anxiety disorders. Areas like trichotillomania, you know, the hair pulling, these pica, these are you know, eating non-nutritive substances. These all come under the anxiety disorders and under different spectrum disorders within the anxiety disorders.
That's interesting. I haven't consulted the DSM in quite a while. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to say, I didn't realize that obsessive-compulsive disorder fell under the anxiety disorders. Is that recent, mm-hmm. or has that been the case for a long time?
Well, it wasn't as defined within the DSM-3, but clearly the DSM-4 and the 4R and the TR have all clearly classified it under the anxiety disorders.
Okay. So,
and then even the spectrum disorders that come under obsessive-compulsive.
Okay. Yeah, now the term spectrum disorder, you say that comes under...
Yeah, they would be... some of the spectrum disorders would be like some of the tic disorders, like chronic vocal tics, chronic motor tics, Tourette's, all come under the obsessive-compulsive spectrum disorders, anorexia, bulimia, hypochondriasis...
Now, when I think of Tourette's, I think of something that is almost certainly, I think, probably rooted in the brain or the biochemistry.
Sure.
Is that true? And if so, to what extent is that true of obsessive-compulsive disorder generally, which we used to think of as purely psychological?
Yeah, most of the research today is bearing out the fact there's a very strong genetic factor and a very strong component in the area of the brain called the basal ganglia that is not quite operating the way it needs to be operating. There's kind of two filters in the basal ganglia, one called the caudate nucleus and the other called the striatum. It seems that when those two filters are not working so well, we get that immediately, the ruminative thoughts of obsessive-compulsive and the catastrophic thinking, and we see that there's a very strong genetic component there. We can especially see it within the case of monozygotic twins, even if they were separated at birth, you know. If one has OCD, boy, there's a very high percentage that the other will have OCD also.
Mm-hmm.
So we do see a fairly reasonable genetic component, and some of the research I was looking at see it somewhere within the chromosome area of chromosome 22 to 24 in that area. So they're really identifying some of these things today. And now with what's called the SPECT scan, the single photon electron computerized tomography, we can really see some of the activity of the brain within obsessive compulsive and within anxiety disorders that are clearly different from a brain that is not functioning in an anxious modality. So,
wow, that's really fascinating.
It really is. Yeah. It has been a fascinating area of study for me. I'm just thrilled with it, really.
Yeah. So,
but you know what? The more we know, the more we find out. We don't know is
really
what it amounts to.
Really. I assume there's some kind of interaction, though, between the sorts of factors that you've just taken us through and an environment. Where does environment, learning, family history, does that all play into anxiety as well?
Well, you know what? If there is a genetic propensity, then all of these other factors can be an exacerbation of it. And I think that's what they're looking at today. Instead of a cause and effect, we're seeing perhaps that genetic or chemistry weakness there. And then these other factors, the environmental factors, and all become exacerbation for it. Stress, we're finding, with obsessive compulsive, even if a person is physically sick, he tends to become more symptomatic. When he feels overwhelmed, he goes from perhaps ego syntonic right into ego dystonic, and so we see these components and the environmental context, the stressors in the life, become exacerbation for it. And I think that's probably the direction most of the research is going in today.
Okay, so in other words, if a person has a certain predisposition, then they'll be triggered by factors that might not trigger another person.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
So what does all of this mean for treatment then?
Well, since we've been talking about obsessive compulsive, of course, any of these within the DSM-IV get either classified mild, moderate, severe. Now, when we're talking about moderate to severe, we're probably talking about medication as well as a treatment design, probably a cognitive behavioral treatment design, usually not one without the other. The medications tend to soften the mechanism in the basal ganglia enough that treatment can become pretty effective at that point, some of the behavioral treatment programs or the cognitive treatment programs.
What kind of medications are we talking about?
Right now, we're talking mostly about the SSRIs or the SSNRIs, SSRIs being selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and the SSNRIs would also add norepinephrine in there. So treating the neurotransmitters seems to be the most effective thing in softening the activity of that basal ganglia region of the brain that seems to be so active in most of the anxiety disorders.
Mm-hmm. So that would...
And then you get into a treatment strategy that then works fairly well with the exposure, and response prevention and the cognitive very effective at that point. So.
Okay, we cut out for just a second there. Could you repeat that last sentence?
Yes, I hope that was your phone, Dave.
I don't know what happened, but you just cut out momentarily.
Yeah, okay. Just looking at the treatment designs, where we see that the medications help soften the basal ganglia part of the brain to where treatment can become a little bit more effective.
Yes.
And especially if the person can feel like they have a handle on this thing. Because I think one of the words that best manifests anxiety, any of the anxiety disorders, is the feeling of being out of control. So as therapists, if we can help give them a sense of control or helping them to redesign some of their thinking, and then their thoughts, feelings, and actions start working in a positive direction, and it takes time. It takes repeated exposure to do that. It seems like the brain starts to respond with it. If we can soften it a little bit with some of the medications.
Okay, well,
we've become a little bit disappointed in some of the medications over the years here. So.
Yeah. Are there long-term negative effects on the body? I wonder both about the drugs and also about stress itself, whether or not they're long-term.
Oh, I certainly think there are long-term effects. And some of the studies, especially in an area called the hippocampus, which is memory processing, short-term memory, long-term memory, learning processing, just a small area of the brain, seahorse shape, just behind the amygdala in the primitive part of the brain. But what we have seen is that under prolonged stress, the amygdala actually begins to atrophy, and the hippocampus begins to atrophy.
Wow.
And they think that maybe in some cases of prolonged post-trauma stress, it might be a permanent atrophy. And then they're looking at is this a link then that could be attributed to, you know, this is a stress response, a chronic stress response. Now, what is the ripple effect of that? My goodness, they're looking at its effects on fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, Alzheimer's, maybe even perhaps MS.
Wow.
And as far as perhaps a precursor for some of these.
Yeah. Now,
so we see the long-term effects of stress, you know, and we're just seeing it more all the time now.
Yeah. Now, are they, in fact, the effects of stress, or are they, you know, are they the effects of the stressor itself, or are they in somehow the effect of our reaction to the stressor? In other words, what I tell myself generates an emotional reaction that leads to the atrophy of my amygdala.
Yeah, exactly. But and it becomes our perception, right? So everybody's a different personality, and there's going to be a different sense of perception. And so what might affect one person isn't necessarily going to affect another, but we do see the effects of the chronic, you know, the person who is just suffering a chronic low-grade stress. And that can just build gradually almost to a point of we're just not aware of it, and we only may become aware of it as we see some of the physiological factors or our inability to concentrate or the fact that we're feeling agitated a great deal of the time.
So how does
and
a
we still have an attachment.
Yeah, so how does a person, say, who's listening to this program differentiate between whether or not they're experiencing normal levels of anxiety or pathological levels?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of times they're not aware of it until they maybe go see their general practitioner, you know, or their primary physician, and the primary physician say, you know what, I think you're stressed, maybe you ought to go see a therapist, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they're not aware of it until they have reached that point. And most of my referrals come from medical doctors. They see them first. Mm-hmm. And by then, the medical doctor has probably put them on some kind of an anti-anxiety agent.
Okay. Well, let's talk.
And then they send them to see the therapist.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about panic reactions, because that's something that I think has a lot of the qualities of what you're talking about, where somebody feels like they're – well, you go ahead and describe it. Tell us about the panic reaction and what it is.
Well, I see it as a person who has collected this chronic low-grade stress to the point where little by little their threshold for thrush diminishes, and they're in a sense kind of walking on thin ice, and then almost anything can send them through. And a lot of times, a panic reaction can happen right out of their sleep, because there's usually a sleep disorder that ends up developing with it too, where they're not getting very good sleep, and then they get spikes of REM sleep that might send them right into a panic attack right out of their sleep. And or it might manifest itself in a specific phobia. All of a sudden they have a phobia, or maybe an agoraphobia, or maybe they can't go across the bridge and they're saying, you know, what in the world is this? You know, I can't go away from my home.
Yes.
I very often see business executives, type A personalities, that almost thrive on adrenaline. You know, they thrive, they love it, and yet it catches up with them. Mm-hmm. And I end up treating them with they're probably already on a medication, and I'm going to treat them with how to relax, relaxation mechanisms.
Yes,
to some degree, and then get into some cognitive restructuring as to how not just to develop coping skills, Dave, but perhaps developing some life management skills.
Okay.
Maybe coping skills aren't always the best idea here.
Yeah. What do you mean by that? I saw on your flyer a reference to something you called life management therapy, and what does that refer to?
Yeah, how could it's probably the difference between reactive and proactive. When people are stressed, they tend to want to learn skills, how to manage their stress or how to cope with their stressors in their life. Where I think maybe one of the best jobs that we have as therapists is help them develop a better life management so that they're not in this situation all the time where they're trying to cope, where they're always putting out emotional fires or worry fires, you know. But maybe they have to shift their life around a little bit or shift their thinking around a little bit to where they're managing their life instead of just coping with things. It's kind of the difference if you see a person drowning and you throw them a life preserver, you know, in a sense, that's a coping skill. You know, you're in over your head, I'm going to throw you a life preserver so you can keep your head above water. And I'm not sure that's the best way to go through life, trying to keep your head above water. Mm-hmm. maybe helping them learn how to not get into the deep water, or maybe teaching them how to swim, or maybe even build a boat. You know, and what I see are more life management skills. Of course, your third-party payments are not real nuts about that idea, because it takes longer, and it's work that you're doing with a client over a longer period of time and helping them rethink how to manage their life, how to prioritize their life, how to get things in management.
Yes. Now, your lifestyle sounds like it could be very stressful. I mean, you're traveling all over the country every other
week.
Well,
thanks a lot, Dave. Well, you're right. You know, but I've had to build into this thing myself, you know, because I adjunct teach at a university. I'm traveling every other week, 75 cities a year. I see 25 to 30 clients on the week that I'm here in the office. But, you know, the way that I manage it is I make sure I am off on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, that sounds pretty good, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So you are being mindful of bringing some balance into your own life.
That's exactly right, because I need it, because after I have finished a week of teaching, you know, when you're doing a six-hour seminar and then traveling to the next city and doing the seminar again, the next city and doing a seminar, you get pretty exhausted. You just get drained. You feel good, you know. There are good stressors that still catch up to us, you know. It's called eustress.
Yes.
And I have got to keep the balance in my life. And so I pretty much safeguard my decompression time very much, and my wife and we have had to, you know, I've been married 33 years here, and we have had to work out the balance in our life. I've got two kids, had to work out the balance there, mm-hmm. a balance in our marriage, a balance in my relationship with my kids, and I think it's about keeping your life in balance, mm-hmm. and it's what I call life management.
Okay.
You know, just
what do you do? What do you do in your downtime? What do you do to de-stress?
Well,
I mean, are you a reader,
looking,
a fisherman? Do you have hobbies? What do you do?
Well, you know, we have a small wakeboard boat, you know, and we live near a lake, and so sometimes my wife and I, we will go to Applebee's and get a takeout and go out in the middle of the lake and just anchor out there and fish. I don't put a hook on my fishing line because I really don't want to be bothered with a fish. But but I like to go through the motion of it anyway.
That's great.
You know, heck, if I want to be bothered with a fish on there and have to do all that.
Right.
But the idea of fishing sounds pretty good. You know? So the name of my boat is Therapy, so my office manager can say, well, you know, he's in therapy today.
Yeah, very good.
Well, maybe right out in the middle of the lake, you know. But then my kids come around and they say, Dad, let's go wakeboarding or something like that, you know, and it becomes a real great diversion. And I finally have a grandbaby, and that has just changed my life, Dave. My goodness, this new grandbaby.
Yeah, I just got one myself, so I know what you're talking about.
You did.
Yeah.
And so it's a matter of stepping back and saying, you know, what's important? Are there things that I can let go of? You know, people tend to want me on boards, either school boards or church boards or whatever. And I did that route for quite a bit, and, you know, out of a sense of obligation, you know. But, boy, I've backed out of a lot of that now. And if I can do it, and if it keeps within the balance of my life, I'll do it. Otherwise, you know, I've got to keep my priorities straight here. So,
yeah, good.
Of just a balanced life.
Yeah, yeah. If you hadn't become a psychotherapist, what might you have become instead?
Well, you know, I dabble in a variety of things. I've built a couple of houses myself, so I love the construction part.
Wow.
And so I could be a general contractor.
Interesting.
I flew a little bit, so you know, every once in a while I could have been a pilot because I love flying.
Yeah.
Just the freedom of being totally in control of your own aircraft, you know, and you're up there doing Chandelles and Lazy Eights and just relaxing. I enjoy that too. So I enjoy teaching. I really enjoy sports, and my daughter's still in college, and she loves me to come up to the university and go to ball games with her, you know, so we keep that on. So I'm not sure, you know, I dabble in many things.
Okay. Yeah.
A lot of hobbies. I have a little craft workshop at home, and I love to get out there and try to create something.
That's great.
But that's just me. That's how I have to do it.
Yeah.
That's how I decompress. Diversity. My kids are kind of turning out the same way. My wife is pretty much the same way. We love to get out in the yard and do our own landscaping, and we have a pond nearby, and sometimes we keep the pond pretty well stocked. So,
well, it sounds like you have a
family likes.
You have a very full and balanced life. I wonder if you have any recommended reading for our listeners. Do you ever recommend reading to your patients?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
What's at the top of the list? What's at the top of the list?
Depending on if I'm in marriage counseling, you know, there would be books on communication. Sometimes Gary Chapman's work, you know, in the area of the five love languages, learning how to talk each other's language, you know.
Yeah.
Men and women seem to speak a little different marriage, like Mars and Venus.
Yeah,
and so I will often recommend books like that in the areas of anxiety. It just absolutely depends on what we're talking. If I'm working with obsessive compulsive disorder, there is the obsessive compulsive disorder workbook that my clients tend to really like to do because they're obsessive compulsive anyway, and it really gives them something to work on, you know, and really get into
it. Interesting.
So,
okay,
but,
well,
As far as references, my goodness, we could go on and on with references.
Sure.
Depending on the area of disorder that we're talking about. You know?
Sure, but, sure. Well, before we go, I want to mention that you do have upcoming workshops here in California. In fact, I'm planning to attend one in San Francisco on March 29th, 2007. And so if there are other professionals listening, if you're in Fresno, there's going to be one on March 13th, and in Oakland there's one on March 14th, and in Reno there's one
That's
on March
right.
15th, Sacramento, March 27th, San Jose, March 28th.
So yeah.
You're going to
And we just talked about what a balanced life I have, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So if there are any professionals.
I look forward to the run in California. I really do. I enjoy that. I do that about every 3 years, and I just really enjoy that run out there.
Yeah, that's great.
And I'll get into Reno and then probably get out to Las Vegas a little bit, you know.
So,
and every once in a while, about once a year, I do a cruise, too, where I speak on a cruise in the morning and help people with some relaxation skills on the cruise. You know, now that's a tough job, you know, to have to, but somebody's got to do it.
Somebody's got to do it, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, Dr. Wayne Eastlack, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hey, what a pleasure it was, Dave. Anytime, let's do it again.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Wayne Eastlack. Towards the end of our discussion, I mentioned that he's conducting workshops on the anxiety disorders around the country. And so if you're a professional and you're looking for continuing education units, you might be interested in taking one of his workshops. I know that I'm planning to. I've decided to accumulate CE units so that I can become a provider of them for other psychologists. And I have let my psychology license be inactive for a number of years since I haven't been seeing therapy clients recently. But I want to accumulate these units so that I can make a case for becoming a provider. So at any rate, if you're in the U.S. and you're a professional and you would like to take a course like this and get units for it, either as a counselor or a psychologist or a psychiatrist, you can find out more by going to the site that coordinates his workshops as well as other people's. It's www.crosscountryeducation.com. In the interview, I mentioned the kind of anxiety that I have suffered at 3 a.m. sometimes when I wake up. And to me, that's always felt like kind of the prototypic model of what it is to experience anxiety. But actually, I don't suffer from that nearly so often now. And in part, I think it's because I've learned some good mental habits. I've learned how to deal with it. For one thing, to recognize that this is something that happens, that my biological systems are at their low ebb in the middle of the night like that. And so I can kind of deal with it cognitively, you know, by understanding what's going on. And so I just don't allow myself to get into that worry cycle that would happen otherwise. And one of the techniques I use is a meditative technique of focusing on my breath or even counting my breath. Usually this will get me back to sleep. If that doesn't work, you know, I can always turn the light on and read if I want to for an hour or so. And then the REM clock will have rolled around to the place where, you know, in the sleep cycle where I start to get sleepy again, and it'll be much easier to go to sleep. So rather than just kind of laying there and sweating and anxiety about it, I find it's better to dismiss it, to not worry about it, and to either count my breath or focus on relaxation or just get up and read for a while. I think that anxiety was a much bigger issue for me when I was a young adult. And I wonder if maybe that's true in general, if people sort of earlier in their life tend to be more anxious and tend to worry more. I might be overgeneralizing from my own experience, but I know I was very anxious throughout college and especially in graduate school. Graduate school seemed like such a big thing, having to write a doctoral dissertation to do original research, and I just didn't have enough self-confidence to believe that I could do all of that. And so I suffered a lot of anxiety throughout, which is too bad because it was totally unnecessary. I did get through and I did pull everything off. And, you know, so it's taken me, it's taken me a lifetime to learn that the things that I worry about, by and large, they don't come true. And so worry is really wasted. So if you're a young person out there, I hope maybe you can take that lesson of mine to heart. It's taken me a long time to learn it, but I feel like I have made some progress in that regard. Also, in a previous show with Are You Serious, where we were talking about Timothy Leary, and we were talking about psychedelics, and I mentioned that I had taken psychedelics when I was a doctoral student, and I haven't in 30 years or more. And I said that I'm not proselytizing for them, even though I had some very positive experiences. I had some mystical insights that really helped open me up to, I think, the spiritual dimension and to other possibilities that we explore in this show here. And also, I felt that I really got a taste of, at least in part, what it must be like to be psychotic. it really felt like I had an insight into the world of the schizophrenic and what it was like to have one's perceptions so dramatically altered. I'm not sure I could have understood it in the same way without having had those experiences. At the same time, though, I have to report that I experienced enormous anxiety on the backside of those psychedelic trips. Just massive anxiety where all I could do was hanging on by my fingernails to my sanity, just waiting for the drug to wear off, at least retaining that knowledge that eventually it would wear off. But I had to endure hours and hours and hours of just massive anxiety. So that experience of anxiety really continues to give me second thoughts about ever taking a psychedelic again, and certainly causes me restraint in suggesting that anybody else try them. I mean, really, it would have to be their own responsibility. I'm not proselytizing or advocating them because it can be a very, very challenging journey, and you really have to be prepared to endure some intense anxiety. Certainly, that was my experience. So I leave you with the inimitable words of the Indian guru Meher Baba, who is quoted as saying, "Don't worry, be happy."
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And shrink wrap radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink wrap radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Once again, a big thank you to our sponsors, Podshow and GoDaddy. You'll find great GoDaddy discounts for all your domain name and web hosting needs on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. I think I may have mentioned in the previous podcast that the Shrink Wrap Radio logo has somehow miraculously appeared on the front page of the podcast section in the iTunes store. And it's still there. Yay! It doesn't come up instantly, but it's in rotation now with about 8 others. Now, nobody knows the algorithm that the Apple team uses for deciding who gets front page billing. So it's not anything I was able to make happen. If I had to guess, though, I think one of the things that may have helped is all the very positive reviews that you listeners have posted on the iTunes site. If you've got good things to say and you haven't posted them there, and you can figure out how to do so, it would be much appreciated to have some more of them up there. Maybe that'll help me stay up there or get me up there again. At any rate, I think this front page billing has given a definite boost in the number of subscribers, and I really like that. And by the way, if you're not a subscriber, please become one. It's totally free and just means the show will automatically crop up in your podcatcher of choice, whether that be the iTunes, Podshow, or some other software. You can subscribe right on our shows page at Shrink Wrap Radio, or at shrinkwrapradio.podshow.com, or from within iTunes. Another possible source of the bump in our numbers is the series of videos I've been putting up on YouTube in response to the new Hollywood movie on the Zodiac. If you've come to Shrink Wrap Radio as a result of seeing those, I'd really be interested in hearing from you. Now, we've got a number of new additions to our Frapper map, so I want to give a big thank you and welcome to Tim in Orlando, Florida, Steve in Albury, New South Wales, Australia, Maureen in San Jose, California, Esther in Barcelona, Spain, where I spent some time as a young man, long time ago, Christine in Las Vegas, Nevada, Mario in Sardinia, Italy, Gary in Halifax, Nova Scotia, John in New Egypt, New Jersey, Chad in Monterey, California, and finally Gord in Guelph, Ontario. The last two or three I might have mentioned before. I'm not sure if I did. I'm sure you won't mind having your name read out again. And if I didn't read out your name, hey, there's a place on the Shrink Wrap Radio website where you can add yourself to our Frapper map. So go ahead and do it. And also, I want to remind you of my other podcast interview series, which you will find at wisecounsel.mentalhelp.net. The latest interview there is on the topic of what to do when your adult children are in the midst of a divorce. So you might want to check that one out. Last time I shared some results from our web survey, which you can find on our website. You'll find a link to it if you haven't taken it. And I thought you might be interested to know a little bit more. It turns out that 29% of you are single, 15% of you are in a domestic partnership of some sort, and 45% of you are married. Only 8% are divorced, and 2% are widowed. 56.4% of you are homeowners, and 43.6% of you are not currently homeowners. And let's see, maybe in terms of the number of children under 18 years living in the home, 70% of you have no children under 18, almost 71% have no children under 18. And then the rest of you have varying numbers of children. So I'll give you more results from the survey next time.
Hi, this is Lloyd from Australia, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks for that transition, Lloyd. And speaking of Lloyd and transitions, he's just become the father of a bouncing baby boy by the name of Lucia. I hope I pronounced that right. Is it Lucia or Lucia? Let me know, Lloyd. And Lloyd, thanks for the photos you sent as well. Mom, dad, baby all look to be doing very well. Lloyd also sent an email saying he preferred my older jazz theme music to that which I've started using recently. I mentioned that he was the first person to comment on the changed theme music, and he wrote back as follows. In that case, you may have not had any feedback on your new unscripted podcasting style either. Here's mine. I like it. It obviously works for you and comes across as natural and spontaneous, more like a conversation than an interview. Everything is overproduced these days, so it's refreshing to hear rawer, realer material. That is what podcasting is all about. It always surprises me to hear about the lack of feedback from your listeners, particularly when you've asked for it. Regards, Lloyd. So, Lloyd, thank you for that feedback as always. And, of course, what Lloyd is referring to is I used to script everything out, kind of write out my commentary, and I just found it to be too time-consuming. So now I just make little notes to myself, and then I try to extemporize on the notes. And it is rawer, so I'm glad to get the feedback that it's working for at least one listener, and I suspect for others as well. Then we hear from Jeff up in Canada, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I enjoyed your recent show on the subject of memory with Thomas Crook." Great, I'm glad to hear that. "During the program, I noticed that you made reference to finding the piano somewhat frustrating as far as memory demands are concerned. You are not alone here. The memory work associated with the instrument can be considerable. Oh, to be a flute player, only one note at a time, and an instrument that's 1,000 pounds lighter." You know, actually, I played the recorder for a while and actually got to the place where I could read music to some degree for the recorder. That was fun. Unfortunately, I drifted away from it and forgot everything I learned. He goes on to say, "As you know, it's the piano's polyphonic capabilities that make the memory work very taxing." Well, that among other things, like having to use two hands and 10 fingers. He says, "That's fine for professionals who can afford to devote hours and hours to the activity, But the question arises, what about us folks who simply want to have fun and make music? Indeed. For myself, I found the answer in playing the blues style of music. Once a few basic scale patterns and chords are mastered, they can be combined in endless combinations that free one from memorization, yet allows for hours of playing enjoyment. Once these patterns are seen for what they are, they can be frequently recognized in many pop music structures, thus allowing for easy mastery of many other songs that aren't strictly based on the blues format. Now, I don't know if you like the blues, but as the soulful person that I believe you to be, I can't think that you would dismiss the blues as unworthy of musical exploration. And he goes on in his email to offer me very explicit musical notation for playing the blues. Thanks so much, Jeff, for taking the time to do that. You're definitely right. Dr. Dave is much too soulful not to love the blues. In fact, I've loved the blues ever since I picked up the guitar way back in college. And I've been able to translate some of that feeling to the piano. And in fact, did learn the basic chords and the basic scale and pattern for doing blues. And yet I kind of stalled out anyway, having difficulty counting the number of bars in the 12-bar blues, getting a left-hand pattern going and keeping it consistent. All of that I'm finding very, very challenging. But your email really encourages me to maybe get back into it. I kind of miss it. If I just sit down at the piano and start noodling around, eventually it drifts into a blues mode every time. Next, we hear from Maureen, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. My name is Maureen from San Jose, California. I'm a new listener to Shrink Wrap, and I must say I'm very glad to have found you. I've never subscribed to any podcast before, and the other day, on a whim, an intuitive moment, if you will, I decided to check out the available podcasts in the iTunes store. I wasn't quite sure why I was browsing there, but your icon caught my eye first, so I clicked on it. Now, I have to back up a bit and say that I've always prided myself in my ability to, quotes, follow my gut, my intuition. It's this ability that has brought me to the places, experiences, and relationships I have today. I've recently been experiencing numerous vivid dreams and have been troubled by their content. I had no idea you specialized in dream work until I started listening to your podcast. Actually, the first one I listened to was episode number 1 about intuition, then subsequently episode number 51, your interview with Jeremy Taylor. His insight about listening to the messages in our dreams, especially those we deem nightmares, gave me some real good footing as to the nature of the dreams I've been having lately. Needless to say, I'll be checking out his book, Dream Work. So that being said, I'm very thrilled to know you are out there, and I'm very glad I followed my gut to find you. I'm hoping that as I listen, I will be able to tackle the images that have haunted me in my dreams. You know, you mentioned that most people cannot recall 5 or so of their dreams, but I must beg to differ. I have only twice actually written down dreams I've had, but I can recall in vivid detail more than 15 to 20 of the dreams I've had in my lifetime. I'm 28. Is this unusual?" You know, I don't know if it's unusual or not. That remark was a bit off the cuff and not based on any research. It's more a generalization from my own experience. So I really ought to ask more people how many dreams they can recall. But my impression is that it is unusual to vividly recall 15 to 20 dreams. But I could be wrong. I don't know. She goes on to say, "I don't know, but you have encouraged me to start writing down the dreams I have from here on out. Good for you. They're becoming more intense with more detail than ever, and I would love to pick your brain sometime on the content of these dreams. So thank you for your show. The information you bring to the masses is not only informative and educational, it has become somewhat of a study for me. You now have a loyal listener in your neck of the woods. I signed up on the Frapper map. Great. So you can check out my picture as well." I did. A very nice looking young woman. And thank you again, she says, and I hope to hear back from you sometime soon. Take care and keep up the wonderful work. Eagerly listening, Maureen. And Maureen, there are more episodes there on dreaming, and there are more to come. So I think that better wrap up the email for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. And you can also leave voice messages and transitions on MyChingo. Just find that logo on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. And in the U.S., you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-888-2746. Hey, I'm dying to hear from you. So send me some email, leave me a voice message, do something. Thanks again to Dr. Wayne Eastlack for the interview. Our next show is called In Praise of Sweet Darkness with my friend Dr. Shepherd Bliss. I think you'll find it interesting. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.